Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean, I just feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
And we're talking about stillness. And it's a snow weekend here in New York. It's one of those still weekends when it snows. And, you know, I woke up Saturday afternoon, to the beautiful sounds of snow shovels scraping across concrete. And I looked out the window, saw the snow drifts there, and realized I needed to buy new shoes. And that's why I haven't left the apartment all weekend. But we're not talking about me. We're talking about stillness. We're talking about David Nickturn, who is our teacher today, who was talking about the power of stillness. This was a talk that was recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering just a few weeks ago, back in December. David Nickturn has been practicing and teaching meditation since the 70s. He is the author of the new book, Awakening from the Daydream, Reimagining the Buddha's Wheel of Life. Awakening from the Daydream. Buy it on Amazon. You can buy it right now as you're listening to this, to me, right now. He's also an Emmy Award-winning and Grammy-nominated musician. Not only is he those things, he's also teaching at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York next weekend, our Shambhala Training Weekend 1. This is our introductory weekend meditation program. If you have been listening to the podcast for a while, you've been interested in meditation, doing a little meditation perhaps, Shambhala Training Weekend 1 is a great opportunity to dive in. And this is going to be a great weekend. David Nickturn is co-teaching this weekend with his son, Ethan Nickturn, who is also a regular contributor to the podcast. So if you're interested, check that out. Go to ny.shambhala.org. Click classes and programs and scroll down to Shambhala Training Weekend 1 for more information and to register. And now, here is David Nickturn talking about
the power of stillness. It may seem obvious to some, but meditation is an unusual activity compared to most of the activities, right, that we do, in which there's some, at least some notion of we even move more in our sleep than we do when we're meditating. Right, so there's a kind of obvious but significant piece of it that we're still. We're allowing ourselves to be still. It's unusual. There's no good way to, like, videotape meditators. We've tried that, you know, for, like, trailers and, you know, website and things like that. It's like, gee, that looks like a photograph. Walking meditation, at least they're sort of moving somewhat zombie-like around the room, you know. So what's the meaning of this? Why do we recommend this to people? So it may appear to somebody looking from the outside that you're still, but I think most of you have already recognized that your mind is still moving. Have you noticed that? Despite, it's kind of like a squirrel on a leash. Somebody tried to sell me one in Mexico once. I think they were a little hard up for cash. But kind of that's a little bit like our mind in meditation. It's a little bit like a squirrel on a leash. Like we've taken this beautiful posture, and most people can manage some version or variation of that at least for a minute or two or 5 or 10 minutes. And you'd think the mind would just go, my master has allowed me to just settle down here for a minute. So since the body is still, I can just rest my mind for a minute. But I, oddly, you see what I mean? Oddly, the mind is even seems to be moving faster for most people when they're meditating. But actually, that's not true. Mostly, we're just noticing the movement of it, the activity of the mind. So this is gives us an opportunity, in a way, to access who we are in a completely different way. The mind is the hidden part of us. You know, when you shake hands with somebody, don't shake minds with them, right? So the body situation is kind of more tangible, easier to access. But and speech, you can hear me, right? Everything. But if I just sat here, you might not know what I was thinking. It's possible. But yet there's tremendous activity going on. And even more mysteriously, we might ourselves not even know what we're thinking. So the mind is also, oddly, and I've been really contemplating this a lot lately, hidden from its owner, or at least good pieces of real estate are hidden from the person who has the mind in the first place. So we were in Maui, right, a couple of weeks ago, and our friend Pete Holmes, who's a comedian, a Dharma guy and a comedian, he did an HBO special. I don't know, maybe even some of you saw it, but he did this one bit in it, which really struck me as funny, but also really like kind of provocative. And he said, what's this about a nightmare? He said, what's a nightmare? He said, it's your body. You put it down in your bed, under your sheets, on your pillows. You know who you are. You know what experience you've had, right? And then you kind of pass out a little bit, you know. You can tell somebody sleeping by looking at them. They're not so responsive as they usually are. But in there, all of a sudden, the mind reawakens inside a dream situation, right? And then in the dream, he said, there's a box in your dream. And it's your dream and it's your box. But you look at the box with a sort of sense of dread, you know. You somehow feel off and nervous a little bit. Right? You've all had a dream. It's called a nightmare. Have you ever had one? No. Many, okay. This could be one of them right now, but we'll see. So you look at the box, right? And then you go to open the box because you're terrified, but you're curious also at the same time. And then two snakes come out of the box, you know. Right? And then you're really frightened and you start to what do they call it? Flight or? Yeah, fight or flight. And you get stuck. You don't know which to do. You would think it's your dream. You should be able to, like, pick up the snake and kiss it if you wanted to. I mean, there's, but yet, that's our own mind. The point that he was making in the funniest, that's our own mind generating all of that, you see, right? Is that discussable? Is nobody else's radio broadcasting your dreams into your head? It's your own mind expressing itself. Yet the imagery and the content of it seems alien to us, and also even somewhat distracting and somewhat upsetting. So this is the mind has many layers to it. Even when you stop the activity of the body, you experience the mind, you see, more vividly. That's the whole argument for meditation. That's the whole point of it, is to become familiar with your own mind. And therefore, in a way, you could say, understand yourself better, much clearer, by direct observation, by directly experiencing your own mind. So I think it's a very big misunderstanding for many people. I've been studying meditation for about, what do you call it, half a century? Is there a word for that? Half a century, okay. So, you know, I've tried a lot of things. You know, it's we were taught a lot of methods and techniques, but a lot of them give you space. You notice during the trainings here, kind of they give you an outline of a technique, sort of sit and breathe, pay attention to your breath, and then you go like, is that it? Is that all I'm doing? And then they leave the room, and you're in there going like, I hope I'm doing this right. It's funny. Have you people lost your sense of humor completely? Somebody comes in and says a few words, pay attention to the breath, when you notice you're thinking, come back, and then they leave. So there are very few spiritual trainings in which they just leave you alone like that and kind of go, okay, you figure it out a little bit. You could say it's a form of lack of caring. You know, the teacher does that to you. But it's also high respect, because the implication is you will be able to figure it out. We just need to give you some space and time to work with your mind and use your natural intelligence to understand your own mind better, given some space and some stillness. So, you know, instructions in meditation should be like finger painting. That was Trungpa Rinpoche used that expression, finger painting. You just suggest outline of a technique, and then the person has to work with it themselves quite a lot. The more you get into this, kind of in a way, the more time over thousands of years, they just said, okay, I'll be back in a month. Some of the teachers just put you in a cave and they say, I'll see you in a month. And you go, you know, you're like Ralph Cramden on the honeymoon, or saying, you know, and maybe somebody's going to bring you some food. That would be good. You know, so the question is, are we brave enough to be with ourselves? That's really the $64 question, with all your toys taken away. All the toys, all the tchotchkes that they give you to meditate with. And sooner or later, even in the high tchotchke tantric Buddhist tradition, they take it all away. And you're sitting there, you're naked and alone, and you have the capacity to abide in that way. So that's very powerful. When we allow the body to settle, there's another aspect. Mind has this dimension of thoughts. Have you noticed you think quite a bit? Anybody doesn't think too much? I think most of you think a lot, and that's why I got to write a book about the different things that we're thinking. It's called The Six Realms. If anybody studied the Wheel of Life, that's what we're talking about, is the different types of thoughts and lifestyles that we get engaged with. Because as you know, you could have a pattern of thinking really nice, happy thoughts and upbeat, or you could be driving yourself into the pits of despair and anxiety. It's hard to tell from the outside why somebody would choose one or the other of those. And then everything in the middle. And during a day, we're just spinning out yards and yards of conceptual discursive mind. So that's what I call the daydream in the book. See, because we know about the night dream with the box and the snakes, but it hasn't really occurred to most of us that we're doing that right now, the box and the snakes. We're just thinking, I hate this place. This is a weird place. You know, why didn't they fix that fan? It's rattling while I'm trying to listen to the talk. You know, or you think, wow, I finally found a place in New York where people are nice and you can sit still. You're spinning, you're weaving. We're weaving in our heads all the time. It's just when you stop the motion of the body, you begin to really notice it. It becomes apparent or observable. So our recommendation is that you do take the opportunity to observe your own mind rather than trying to squish it like a bug. Like, let me just... Don't take this person, but you don't know where the switch is to turn it off. Nobody knows. So it's better to just go, well, let me just work with it. Let me be friends with it. Let me relax a little bit. Let me explore a little. Let's engage a process of discovery rather than in a process of repression and manipulation. You know? And, you know, personally, I've come to have a lot of confidence in people that it's much more workable than most people think. And we don't have to run as fast as we're running to get away from ourselves. Or to look good, or to do something in a certain way. There's time. there's space to explore. So from my personal point of view, the meditation is, of course, it sort of targets certain types of contemplative and compassionate and wise and wakeful activities. But there's no bullet train, particularly. So you're going to take time, and while you're doing that process, there is a really good argument for being kind to yourself about the whole thing. And also being curious about the whole thing. And having a sense of humor about it, because it is, to me, at this point, the ultimate irony that we don't know ourselves fully. Because we are ourselves already. How could we not know? How could that dream happen and you don't know? It's your mind. So there's a little bit of an ironic, or a joke, you could say. Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about the cosmic joke. The cosmic joke is ego, that you think you're a special person in a special time and place, and actually it makes us nervous because we think, well, I better defend that. And then you can see how crazy that gets. We're seeing what ego's folly looks like at a national stage, you know, if you're open to it. I'm not just talking about one dude either. I mean, the whole game is kind of silly. And people are blowing each other up over ego and, you know, and kind of starving themselves because of ego. And all we mean by ego is a very heavy, fixed idea of who you're supposed to be that gets in your way of actually just being the nice, sweet little putschkalist that you are, you know? That's a Yiddish word for basic goodness. So it seems logical, as Spock would say. First step is sit down, sit on down, settle down. You know, let's not start a whole nother field of activity that's called spiritual practice. Or if we do, let's go easy at it. Because you know already, like how you are when you're learning tennis, right? You want to be in Wimbledon right away. How many people would just take a minute and learn how to hit the ball and hit 1,000 strokes? Those are the people who actually get to Wimbledon, by the way. So let's accept the possibility that we don't have to race in our spiritual practice. There's no race going on. Maybe this is jumping the gun, but there's actually no place to get to. Well, we'll have Q&A. We'll promise, and you'll be first. What's your name?
Jason.
Jason, okay. I promise you will be the first in the Q&A. Maybe I am finished. It's possible. Okay, Jason, give him the mic. Let's have some discussion. Wait for the mic so everybody can hear you, okay?
From the Maharas.
Who?
The Maharas. I might be pronouncing it wrong.
Well, what does it mean?
M-A-R-A-S.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You say there's no place to go. Where you're very articulate, so I'm paraphrasing.
Okay.
What about getting away from the Maharas? Isn't that a reason to practice?
Well, I understand the reference that you're making, but don't put the mic down yet. We're going to actually have a conversation. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. So, what does it mean to you, the Maharas? What do you understand that to be?
There's five Buddha families, and then there's the Maharas come. I'm trying to think of the word. I have a mental block. When I'm saying something profound, I develop a mental block.
Wow. Imagine if that's what happened to Buddha. That would have been funny, huh? No. He knew something really profound, but every time he tried to say it, he had a mental block. Look, Jason, Maras are seductresses, you know, or seductors,
right,
that pull us away from the wakened kind of quality of experience. So they're illusion, that's another word for it. Like when you follow an illusion, like if I shoot this heroin into my arm, I'll be happy. That's a mara, right? Wow. And then what happens is the mara pulls you down that track, and now you're doing that, and then the mara says, "I'll see you tomorrow. I'll be back." Uh-huh. That's called addiction, right? Uh-huh. So, of course, we don't want to live like that. We don't want to live like that. So you're right. We should meditate really, really diligently to defang and defenestrate and castrate the maras.
Thank you.
You're right. It's a good point. Yeah, over here.
So I've noticed that I get panicky about meditating, like what you were saying, because... Yeah. I'd come back from a retreat where I'd gone into some deep meditation, and of course you always come back with this idea like, oh yeah, I'll start sitting for an hour a morning, and that doesn't happen. And then I actually feel like I'm meditating less than before I went on the retreat. And now is like the most crazy time of the year with family and money and all of that. And I'm finding myself panicking about trying to find time in my day to meditate. So... how do you address that? Do you just...
Well, it was a good idea to come here tonight because, you know, the group support is very strong for your intention. So it sounds like you have an intention, but it kind of gets, you know, caught up. Like, here's a funny thing that happened tonight, and maybe it's a metaphor. A friend of mine came tonight to do the other class, and I saw her, and... she was sitting in the office. She had boots, like, up to here. And the zipper got stuck halfway down as she was trying to take it off and then go very reasonably sit down on a cushion and go to a very reasonable meditation class and come out hopefully feeling more reasonable and everything's workable and, you know, my mind is settled now. But now all of a sudden her boot's halfway down and she can't get it on or off, you know. So one of the, hesitate to say employees because this is a volunteer army and that's why we're raising funds tonight. But a noble volunteer was trying to help her with the boot, but they couldn't make it happen. So she got stuck between trying to get the boot on and trying to get the boot off. And that's us. That's us trying to meditate. We sort of want to do it. We can't get the boot on. We can't get the boot off. So some sense of humor is good, right? That you recognize the dilemma that we have. And then some intention is good. That's why we make vows and things like that around here and make intentions and take abhishekas and ceremonies to kind of confirm the fact that we mean to become more enlightened and so forth. But along the way, there's nothing but obstacles. I just want to tell you that. If you encounter something that's not an obstacle, it's because you're not paying attention. So, what are our skillful tools? Intention is one. Discipline, you know, kind of like fundamental quality of exertion and discipline are good. Once you have an intention, you know, you have to kind of lean in, whether it feels good or not, whether there's time or not. It's very challenging. Guilt-free is really good. Gelag Rinpoche used to say guilt is useless in this path. You know, I mean, it's a habit we have of recriminating on top. You just get back on it. You just if you got screwed up and you didn't meditate for 6 months, you just sit down, just start again, like fresh start, those kind of things. Group support, sangha, very good, very good. You know, it's the best kind of community where people are practicing, not just kind of kidding each other all the time, like, oh, you're so great. Like in the entertainment business, oh, I loved your album, it's so great. Everything was so great. She's, I love you all, like somebody standing on a stage. I love all of you. You know, to go, no, you don't. You need us. That kind of honesty, you know, drilling into your heart a little bit for your what you really want to do with your life. Panicking a little bit, but in a disciplined way, like recognizing impermanence is kind of controlled panic. You know, the four reminders, you know that, right? So impermanence, understanding karma, that if you create certain actions and certain thoughts, they will just ripple and keep going around and around, and you're in a spin cycle. Very well articulated in the book, not that I'm selling the book particularly necessarily, but it's really explained in the book how you create. And one of the images is like we go into a spin cycle. You know what a spin cycle is on a dryer? And we're in it. We're going to go, you know, that's us, you know, repeating the same habitual patterns over and over again. And it starts to slow down a little bit. And then we almost have a moment where we're like, hey, I'm just here. And our little hand reaches out from inside and puts another quarter in. That's karma. And does it make sense? So, yeah. So all these things, and you know, do you work with a teacher?
Yeah, he never has time.
Okay. Okay. But, wait a minute.
Okay.
I'm not in a hurry. Don't be in a hurry, okay?
Okay.
So that's the wrong teacher. Period. Sorry to say it, I don't know who it is or what the context is, but no, you need a teacher who has time for you. You're worth it.
Well, I'm also finding right now with my lifestyle where it's like I'm having to choose between preparing my lunch to take to work, which is, you know, better for the environment, better for me and my health, or sitting and practicing, or being late for work. That seems to be my options at the moment.
No. No, I don't believe you.
You don't believe me? Okay,
yeah,
awesome.
Or there are more options for sure.
Okay.
Absolutely for sure.
Awesome, then I will not listen to myself.
Yeah, I mean, don't buy into that. Look, we all do that. I do it. Everybody does it. But we don't have to, like, you know, go to the bank and get that check certified, if you know what I mean. One of my favorite students was a mom of three. One of the kids is autistic. She's a yoga teacher. You know, she got up at 6:30. She practiced every single day. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not trying to hold you to any standard or anything like that, but we have the opportunity to what you're just talking about is a mental loop, you look intelligent, I'm sure you know it.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Is it okay if we just have a dialogue tonight mostly? I feel people need to talk about meditation a little bit, so lately I've been doing more of this.
Hi, David. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just a personal observation, which seems illustrative of something. I don't know what. Well, I do have an idea, which is that you were speaking for a while and then you stopped speaking. And there was silence. And that allowed me to have the experience of just being here in a way that's even... It's hard for me to do that as quickly and easily on the cushion.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me wondering and thinking, why is that? And it occurred to me that your doing that gave me permission. So I just started thinking about that does seem important. And I could give myself permission, I mean, theoretically. But actually, the silence here did something when you just stopped talking and left it there that was so much more useful than something I could do for myself as easily or quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to comment on that because I was kind of surprised myself.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. To your left, there's another... person right to your left.
Could you talk a little bit about you said something about not rushing, you know, and not being in a hurry. And I think something that I think about a lot is how I feel, and I'm not sure if this is completely accurate, but within the Shambhala tradition, there's not so much an emphasis on the sort of more theoretical aspects of Buddhism. It's very experiential at first. And is that part of this idea of if you do lay out this big conceptual framework, people feel an urge to rush through it?
Wow, what an interesting question that is, really.
Thanks.
So you started studying recently here, like within the last 30 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the emphasis moves around. You know, it's a community. It's a living lineage. I think the teachers all are feeling what's appropriate for any particular time and place. Interestingly, you know, Trungpa Rinpoche was a highly trained Buddhist scholar. And when he first came here, just to give you a little background of it, I think he took a look at us and had a little voice in his ear said, "We're not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy." This is, you know, and he thought about how are we gonna do this, you know. I also think he liked us. That's like my own personal opinion. It's like, you know, there was something refreshing here. But he came from a highly formalized education system, like Juilliard of the mind, you know. And we were like jamming on the back porch with two strings missing on the guitar. So that was the hookup there. But what his choice was to, after a pretty short time, said, okay, I'm going to hold off on the tantric teachings, the Vajrayana Buddhist teachings, and do two things. One is I'm going to give my students some basic mind training, like ground training, shamatha vipassana, settle the mind, focus, which they don't emphasize all that much sometimes in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, that might come later. So I'm going to start there. Had everybody meditating, you know, for long times, you know, and really putting some hours on the cushion in. And then he also said, we have to transplant the entire canon of the nine jhanas of the Buddhist teachings, which he basically did in several years, and those were the early seminaries. If you can buy those transcripts now, by the way, in public. Those were like the kind of esoteric teachings. And it's called The Profound Treasury of Dharma. And you can buy it on Amazon tonight and get all three volumes, Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana teachings. And for somebody like you, I would say, if you got a Bill Fitty hanging around or your Christmas present coming up, couldn't spend it in a better way. And several of the students took years, decades, to organize that into topics.
But is that like, my question is that sort of like an example of wanting to jump ahead where you're,
No, because the books are heavy, so you can't jump with them. As soon as you pick them up, you're like not jumping, you know. So, yeah, but they're dense, I think is a better word. Now, I think the more you expose yourself to that, the more you realize that the jumping ahead thing is a sort of a fantasy of maybe you would become more intimidated. Like if you looked at those books, you'd go like, whoa, this is a lot here. And then you go step by step. So I think it has the opposite effect, actually, Joshua. Now, in the current iteration, I think we have a situation here where many, many people want to study meditation, much more than 40 years ago. It never was on the cover of Time magazine in 1973. The mindfulness revolution, I don't know what revolution it was, but it wasn't that one. So the idea is how could we as a community create a container for people to come in and settle down and appreciate themselves a little bit more and kind of create some kind of good energy as a social form, create some kind of... I've been thinking about this a lot lately. What happened to dignity? What happened to good manners? What happened to having some code that is not, you know, just completely for sale? So restoring some of those kind of forms, I think, is what we're about now, but there's plenty of room to go deep. I'd take personal responsibility in counseling you if that's what you want to do. There's a million ways to do it.
Thank you.
Okay. So, hi.
Yeah. I'm curious about your experiences as a musician and a writer and how meditation has helped you with those or hindered you, because I'm a writer and, you know, my writing has been going really well, but my practice hasn't been going as well, and I don't know how to reconcile both of them.
What do you write? Poetry?
Mostly poetry.
Yeah. You know, we can recreate the energy of this, but poetry was a big part of our dharma at one point. Do you know that? Do you know that?
I've heard a little bit about that, but I'd like to read more. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's books of poems and things like that by both. Mm-hmm. And I would tap into, like, well, what's dharmic poetry? Why did Trungpa Rinpoche get here? And one of the first moves he made was hooking up with,
Ginsberg?
Yeah, Allen Ginsberg, yeah. And Gregory Corso and a whole bunch of people were at Naropa Institute then in Boulder the first couple of years, including Ram Dass, who we just spent a month with. All these people were collected around, and Rinpoche's like very open, so he's just saying, let's see what everybody's got. Now, here's a great story. Here's how Trungpa Rinpoche and Allen Ginsberg met, and there's a point to this story, which is, I'll give it away, synchronicity is the point. They both went for the same cab in New York City. So when you go to the how do you meet a teacher, I say the first thing you need to do is try to hail a cab on a busy day in New York, see who's there. And so that's how they met. And then they both had the mindset of like, okay, let's just share it. That's actually how they met. But they would have poetry sessions, you know. And Rinpoche was a great poet. There was an emphasis with him, and I think with Allen too, maybe before and maybe after even more, of spontaneity, what we call first thought, best thought. You know about that?
Yeah, I've been doing like Natalie Goldberg's Writing Down the Bones, if you're familiar with her, like exercises like that a lot.
Yeah.
But I haven't been doing as much formal meditation. So I'm afraid to like devote more time to the meditation because then I have to figure out other places in my life.
Okay, well, I have an idea for you, and it's just a throw off. What are you doing? Shamatha meditation, the breathing meditation?
Just breathing meditation.
Mindfulness of the breath?
Yes.
Do that for 15 minutes. Then don't move. Sit right there, pick up your notebook, and do poetry for 15 minutes.
See, I like that.
Yeah. Don't mix them.
No.
Don't have an idea five minutes in and say, oh, I forget about this.
I've done that a little bit in yoga workshops. I mean, meditation, it's not really yoga, but...
Yeah.
Okay.
See, part of the problem is that we think of meditation as Mount Everest. And it's over here, and now you're practicing, now you're living your stupid whatever life. They're supposed to mix. But you have to have some base camp. So let's use the example of Mount Everest. You need to get that base camp. You can't just climb to the peak every day. Mm-hmm. The base camp is formal practice. But from there, you can explore and mix. So we have all kinds of, even in this place, we've got, you know, kudo and flower arranging and calligraphy. And these are one step down. But really, all the arts belong in there. And certainly poetry belongs in there. So, but I wouldn't forsake your formal practice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to shift your relationship to your subconscious, actually. It's going to give you access and portals to stuff that are less labored and less, you know, tormented and just... Phew.
Thank you.
So would you make a poem right now? Short
I'll
one?
Write a haiku, and can I get back to you in a minute? We'll pass the mic.
Okay, no.
You
this
want
is
me
not
to
how
write...
we did it.
Okay, how you do it?
Right, boom. First thought.
Red and green have space in the city.
Great. Wow. Well, and in terms of our talk tonight, the red is the stillness, the green is the motion. Right?
Okay.
Do you see that?
Cool. Okay.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Good for you. Yeah, over here in this... There's two people, so we'll get you one after the other.
I am a beginner at meditation, so this may seem somewhat rudimentary, but sometimes once I start sitting, and I've only been practicing in a sangha and in a group setting, it just so far has been working more easily for me. But
it's so. What's the last thing you said? It's so hard, did you say?
No, so far I've only been practicing meditation when I'm sitting in a group sangha setting. Mm-hmm. I have yet to even start my base camp at home. Mm-hmm. But sometimes even if I kind of can accept the thoughts that flow this way, that way, whatever, about all their, you know, swirling around. And sometimes once they quiet down, though, I feel really itchy. And then the question is, like, to itch or not to itch when you're in seated meditation? And
see, now that's a really good question. That's a really good question. What do you think the answer is? Here, you're what would you say?
I try to feel the vibe in a room. Like, is this a cool to itch vibe, or should I not itch? Then I think a little bit about itching, and then I'm like, wait, okay, hold on, that's a thought. Thoughts are my friends. I feel good now. And then maybe I forget that I had to itch at all. And then maybe then the itch comes back, and I'm just like, oh, well, now it's on to the next breathing exercise. And then it's like, oh, shoot, I still want to itch.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't.
But wait, no, don't give the mic back yet. Don't give the mic back yet. So as a point of practice, like if you were able to move into the realm of what the instructions are from the lineage, how to meditate, then how would you approach the itching or not itching issue? Middle way. How would you approach that?
Maybe I just don't know enough because...
Okay, so I'm going to introduce you to the middle way tonight. Is that okay?
Ooh, yes.
Have you heard of that?
No.
So here's one extreme. I'm dying here, and I'm not going to move. And, for example, you will hear stories of Zen monks in mosquito-infested areas and their head blowing up to twice the size, and they don't move or scratch. Let's call that asceticism. Okay. Then you have somebody from, you know, junior high school 104 trying to meditate, you know, and they had to go to the class, and they're just sitting there like, you know, like your teenage friend or kid or whatever, you know, let's call that indulgence or the other extreme. So we're going to go right down the middle, and we're not going to be too ascetic about it. You can scratch yourself, but we're also not going to go in for every impulse that arises. So you have some discipline. Gradually, you can lean more towards that because itches do morph into non-itches. Non-itches morph into itches. It's kind of interesting. But before you become, you know, write your PhD thesis on what an itch is, which I'm close to doing because it's so interesting in a way what an itch is when you're meditating. Like, what happened? Did somebody bite you or did, you know, try the middle way for a while.
Okay,
try practicing at home for 10 minutes a day. Start modest. And try doing that 5 days a week for this month.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciated what you said about the mind and the reality and nightmare and the snakes in the box and them sort of being, you know, I don't know, I guess the illusion of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to ask you, it's not really a question, but I'm wondering if you would speak a little bit about the role of the Mahayana. And, you know, when I heard you say that, I thought, like, yes, that's where I want to go. And then also seeing that there are so many people suffering from being caught up in that illusion. And it seems clear in a seat, you know, in your seat, you're a meditation teacher, so you have an opportunity to bring these practices to people in a very kind of specific way. But for us as just meditators and lay practitioners, how do we engage in the Mahayana, in people being able to see also that illusion of reality?
It's a deep topic. The topic of helping other people comes so close to the core of who we actually are, and also comes so close to some of our most potent illusions about who they are. And, you know, the Mahayana, what I kind of respect, you could say, about the Buddhist training is that you learn on a theoretical level. That's called the view. You understand the teachings. You mix your mind with those. They're very elaborate. Mahayana teachings are, you know, we could spend months just elaborating what the view is, what's said about the thing. Then you mix that with, you're told how to practice those things, which once you start practicing, you realize you just have a kind of, you know, it's like a manual for a Japanese television set, you know. There's some element of, like, you have to figure some things out as you go. But it's pretty clear that you're trying to do those things. Like, if it says exchanging oneself for others, for example, do you remember that? That's a very Mahayana point of view. You take on whatever, the Tonglen, the sending and taking. You take on the other person's challenges and difficulties by actually breathing it in, and you send out to them all your goodies and all your kind of sense of liberation and freedom and delight. Wow, what kind of crazy person would do that? So you could completely misunderstand that, become utterly codependent with everybody you know, an enabler, and you go back to your teacher and say, "No, you missed an essential point there." So there's the view, and then there's the practice, and then there's sort of tweaking as you go, and then there's the fruition of the practice, which is if somebody practices Mahayana really deeply, they'll become a more compassionate person. That's the fruition. They'll become less selfish. So it's noble to have that intention. It's called the bodhisattva intention, right? When you take, how many of you have taken bodhisattva vow? Has anybody taken that? So there's an intention to do what you're saying, is to work with the broader canvas of interdependent relationships. And but immediately, whenever you take that kind of vow, you're struck by how challenging it is to actually manifest that. So hold on one sec. Okay, so the key is recognizing that there are other beings. It's as simple as that. They have their own life stream, their own activity, their own little things they're trying to do, and their own brilliance, and taking some delight in the diversity, the individuality. For me, that's essential, because if you try to just blur it all together and go, "Well, we're all one," I don't think that gives you the key to turn to help somebody for real. You have to see how they're different from you and similar. Then you have, that's compassion. You appreciate their individuality and you appreciate the connection that you have. Then we say you can figure out what to do for them. You know, my the woman who cuts my hair is cut it today. And she's a lovely person. She's telling me about taking care of her 92-year-old mom. And she said, "My mom is really sharp, really on the ball, but she fell," which happens, you know. "And she fell forward, and she has arthritis, so she couldn't block her fall, just fell face down into the concrete, knocked 6 of her teeth out." Right, exactly. You see what you did? So even though that didn't happen to you, you know how it feels. That's the bridge. That's the connection. And then, you know, my friend is trying to help her mother. I mean, it's just kind of, it's a stretch even with your own mother to do that. She's had to put aside some other activities. So to do that, can you imagine doing that for all sentient beings? That's the bodhisattva path. It's impossible. It's unbelievable when you see somebody who's cultivated that to a considerable extent, how relentless they are. Like Trungpa Rinpoche had no privacy ever. Ever. People just came and went. And that was his bodhisattva vow. He didn't turn his back on anybody ever. Now, that doesn't mean he was always sickly sweet to people, though. Sometimes he gave you a zets. But it was a compassionate zets, you know? As far as I'm concerned, this is just my opinion. Okay? I don't know if I answered your question or not. Was it okay? Okay.
So you spoke of the middle way a little while ago. What would the middle way be when you're trying to help? Because I didn't take the bodhisattva vow. I have commitment issues. But
you have what?
Commitment issues. And I was going to say that, but I do try to help and so on and so forth. And what I'm finding is that when you're, it's a painful path, first of all. Constantly impermanent, so on and so forth. Yeah, and then you're helping people and they're in and out of your life. And you have to understand that these people are not going to be there long term, et cetera, et cetera. But you're still being there for them fully and so on. Mm. And as I said, it's painful. Because they're gone, you know, and that's fine. But how do you kind of bridge that gap? You know, what's the middle way there of being able to be service to others and not deplete your own self, like your own heart?
Yeah, so that's a great question, really important question. And it's interesting how stillness, you think we left that topic, but all these things to effectively bring to fruition all the things we're talking about, there has to be some stillness in you. Because otherwise, and I think I might want to just talk about it a little more before we wrap up, we have too much momentum. And if we're like Roadrunner, if we're trying to help somebody, we kind of run right past them because we're not quiet enough to abide with our own mind. So the more you strengthen that root of being willing to settle into yourself, I think you'll find, at least my opinion, easier to help people. The more you feel like restless and kind of ill at ease within oneself, the harder it is. So I would say in that case, you could do personal practice, strengthen that, with the motivation to help others. You know, like dedicating the merit at the end of your personal practice. So you realize that you're strengthening your root of stillness and awareness and openness and fluidity in order to help others. So you'd have that bodhisattva intention. You don't have to make the commitment yet. You could just sort of create a little intention in that direction. When we do settle physically, which is part of the ritual of meditation, there's an opportunity to see the movement and energy, so I'm going to call that thoughts and emotions, arising in your mind stream, and to view it without judgment or analysis. And I would like to suggest that approach for starters, before you start trying to heavily manipulate what's coming up for you. Engage a process of open discovery with a slight bias of knowing that if you're lost there, you come back to the breath. So you could think of it as the breath as an anchor on a boat. The boat's still going to be in the water. You're still going to feel the motion and energy of the mind, but it has an anchor drop down, which is the present awareness of the breath. Here's the final grandmother's advice, okay? Don't be afraid of meditating, and don't be so ambitious. See if you can find a sweet spot between ambition and fear. Okay? That's grandma. I'm grandma now. It's called grandmother's advice. It's traditional in Tibetan Buddhism. And it's gender neutral. See you later.
Thanks, David. Maybe we'll see you later, perhaps this weekend, when you're co-teaching Shambhala Training Weekend 1, the weekend of January 13th. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes, courses, programs, weekend retreats, like the upcoming Shambhala Training Weekend 1. You can email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org, your questions, comments, suggestions, and come see us in person. These talks are recorded live at our weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can come, meet these teachers in person, ask your questions. It's a great time. You meet some other people. Have some cheese, some hummus, crudité. It's cool, man. It's cool. Later.